Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order Wednesday, February 8th. We're going to approach the agenda a little bit out of order, so I apologize for those who are thinking we're going to go in order. We are going to start with House Bill 2112, so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2112.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that prohibits a financial institution from closing an account without an account holder's consent unless there are 60 days notice provided and a reason for the closure. Provides an exception when the financial institution reasonably believes the account was used in conjunction with illegal activity. And there are no amendments before you today.
Good afternoon, Representative Greenlick. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon to you, Mr. Chair, and to members of the committee. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I appreciate you hearing this bill and allowing me a chance to give personal testimony on where it came from. It comes out of my personal experience. One day I get a letter from Chase Bank, where I have three accounts, and the letter says that they decided to close one of my accounts, and they're going to close it as of the first of the next month, which was about 3 weeks away. So I thought, there was a significant amount of money in that account. I thought that was strange. I went to the bank manager and showed him the letter, and he said, "Oh, that's nonsense. I'll take care of it." And he went and made a phone call and came back sort of ashen-faced and said, "No, I can't do anything about it. Not only we're going to close your account, we're not going to open another one for you. I'm not allowed to open another account for you." So I said, "Well, why is that?" And he said, I don't know why it is." So I asked him for the phone number that he had called, found out who he talked to. I got the phone number, I called them, and I identified myself, and I said, you're closing my account. Can you tell me why you're closing my account?" And they said, "No, we're not going to tell you why." I said, "What do you mean you're not going to tell me why?" He said, "Well, we reviewed your account, and we've decided to close it, and we don't have to tell you why. Look at your original agreement. It says we can do it without telling you why." I said, "Well, can I get it delayed for 30 days so I can arrange to transfer my direct deposit, things like that?" I said, "No, it's over on the first of next month, period." I ended up finding other ways to talk to them and hypothesizing why they were doing that, which I'll be glad to share the hypothesis with you if you'd like. But it had to do with some departments of the bank being pissed off at me because a big piece of my business had moved to another bank. I believe was the reason. And I actually got it arranged so that I got another account from the bank, although they continue to close that one. This bill does two simple things. It says that if a bank is going to close your account, they need to tell you why. It seems pretty reasonable. And if it's not for suspicion of illegal activity, they need to give you 60 days notice to arrange whatever you need to do to transfer things. It seems to me this ought to be good business practices anyway. It was very disruptive, though, in fact, because I had to change my Social Security deposit, which is not an easy thing to do, before we eventually got a new account. There was some questions in this whether this applied to only state chartered banks or whether it applies to financial institutions broadly. I asked the LC to give us an opinion on that. I believe you have a memo in your possession from the LC. I was told you do. If not, I will make it available to you. That says their belief is that it applies to nationally chartered banks, credit unions, and other financial institutions, although they say there's a federal exemption. The exemption is if the state passes a regulation that substantially interferes with their ability to do business, they can challenge it. The LC, and you'll see the memo, thinks it probably does not do it. At least the requirement to give you the reason for doing it, they believe will survive a challenge. They say there's it's an open question as to whether the 60-day notice might or might not survive, but they think is their best judgment is that it probably will survive a challenge. That's my sad story.
And it does sound sad. questions from the committee? Representative, I don't believe that we have that opinion. If you wish to share it with us later, if you could maybe email it to the committee administrator.
I'll give you the hard copy and we'll send you an email.
Yep. We'd be happy just to get it in email form, you know, because I'm not going to try to read it right now. So
you could stand at ease and I could read it to you. Or I could go back to the Judiciary Committee where I belong.
That sounds like a promising idea. So, we will get it from you. We'll take a look at it. And we've got some more testimony on it. And we'll take it into consideration.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here this afternoon. Up next, Pam Levitt.
Good afternoon, all members of the committee. Pam Levitt, representing the Northwest Credit Union Association. We would like to explore this bill further, and we thank Representative Greenlick for bringing it to our attention before the session starts. Section 2, sub 2, talking about if the financial institution believes the account to be closed in connection with the illegal activity. We think that needs to be explored a little bit more. In sending this off to our committee, our folks had a few comments, and I'll just let you know those. If the credit union opened an account through identity theft or other fraudulent activity, there may or may not be an identified crime at the time of the closure of the account. There's certainly a variety of situations when we see identity theft or fraudulent activity. We're not sure that fits everything. The account was closed because the funds must be paid per Oregon law to the state under the abandoned property statutes. We send notices, but in many cases we have bad addresses. These are for accounts not used regularly. The member could be engaging in abusive conduct toward a credit union employee or other members in certain situations, and that was an exception they wanted to say. And then the member misrepresented something about the account or is otherwise misusing the account in a manner that may not be considered illegal activity. For example, the member is not within our field of membership, and under credit union law, you need to be within the field of membership to be part of the credit union. So that might not be illegal activity, but would be a reason that we would need to close the account. So there were just a few things that our folks brought up that we wanted to explore and make sure that in some situations we were able to close an account when we needed to. But we certainly will work with Representative Greenlick, and I just wanted to bring those to your attention.
Thank you, Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you say an account is closed, and it has money in it, does that mean it's just kind of put on hold, you can't add to it or take out of it, or does it mean it's completely done away with?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, so there are a variety of situations when you close an account, and usually a member would be at the desk, and you can, you know, certainly we're not closing accounts with money in, and we would certainly give the money to the member. Okay. That's your question.
Sure. Actually, you know, if a member closes the account, sure, they close it, they get the money out. But when the bank closes it, I mean, if they haven't notified the person that they're closing the account, and all of a sudden the representative goes in, he doesn't have an account, you know, and they haven't notified him yet, and they didn't say they handed him a check or anything for the amounts in there, it was just kind of vague, I guess.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barreto, I guess the comments and feedback I received from our folks is that we would absolutely be notifying members in any situation.
Other questions? Representative Fahey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know how other states treat, if other states have any of these policies in place?
Chair Holvey and Representative Fahey, I don't, but we can certainly look into that and get back to you.
So my question would be, you know, when your folks looked at this, I know it doesn't have attached ORSs to it, which may make you a little bit nervous, but it does say it's added to and made part of the Bank Act. So I'm curious whether you think this would apply to credit unions.
Chair Holvey, there is definition and statute for financial institutions that include credit unions. So and we believe that it does apply to credit unions.
Even though it said it's in Section 1 made part of the Bank Act.
Chair Holvey.
We can certainly explore that because there's no ORS is mentioned for the Bank Act itself.
Chair Holvey, when our attorney reviewed that, he believed that we were included within this bill.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Up next, Tim Martinez and Ken Sherman.
Mr. Chair, should we ask Representative Barton to call in, former Representative Barton to call in, because of Mr. Sherman?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. If you'd announce yourself or identify yourself for the record.
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to testify here today. To my right is Ken Sherman, Jr., longtime counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association. I'll let him address a couple of the questions that were raised by committee members. But I would just start off saying that it is our very strong belief that the plain language of the bill makes this part of the Bank Act. The credit union has their own act. You had a hearing on one of their bills last week where they were making amendments to the Credit Union Act. And it certainly seems real clear to us anyway that this bill would only apply to banks. When I talked to the sponsor of the bill staff in December, that was what he told me at the time as well, that they thought it was going to apply to banks and not necessarily credit unions, and they did not object to that at the particular time. We would strongly disagree with legislative counsel's, and I don't know how much analysis they went in as far as preemption. While there were some changes to preemption made in the Dodd-Frank Act of a few years ago, it is still very clear to us anyway, and we'd hate to have to go to court to find that out, but it's very clear to us that this bill would simply apply to the now, I'm not sure the exact number, but 23 or 24 Oregon's community banks and the larger banks. So the small community banks in your area, this bill would apply to and would, and again, in our opinion, not necessarily solve the issue that occurred with Representative Greenlink. And I would just say, Representative Bredo, I mean, you saw he did get notice. I mean, we notice on everything, change of terms, change of anything you notice. When I started to give an example of how banks get in and out of different lines of business, when I started with the Bankers Association in 1990, many, many of you that are of that age, some of you aren't, but many, many of you that were of that age, banks made car loans right and left. Now, I would suggest you'd be fairly hard-pressed to find many banks. There are still some that do, and certainly some that have business customers where they want to have the whole book of business, but not many banks make car loans anymore. I mean, that's just a decision that they've made. And in this case, the bank in question decided to get out of the business of dealing with elected officials, and they did that nationwide. Representative Greenlink was not the only person that had that letter. So we think this bill would only get at your community banks, not the credit unions, and not the national bank. So we would encourage you. I'll be happy coming by to talk to all of you about the bill after the hearing. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to talk to most of you prior to the hearing, and be happy to answer any questions at that point or today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Sherman, who has some comments, and he's also provided you copies with that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association, and I want to elaborate just briefly on Tim's remarks concerning the applicability of the bill. There seems to be this confusion about whether credit unions are covered, and the reason they're not is because credit unions are not governed by the Bank Act, and this bill would add its provisions to the Bank Act. So in order to cover credit unions, you would have to actually amend Chapter 723. As well as the addition to the Bank Act. National banks are the question of preemption, and that applies not just to national banks, but also to federal credit unions and also to federal savings banks. So there's three classes of institutions that would argue very strenuously that this bill, as the provisions of this bill, would not apply to them because their deposit relationships are governed by the federal laws that apply to national banks, et cetera. So there's some kind of serious questions there about who this applies to, and it would seem inappropriate from our standpoint if we ended up with a law that imposes new requirements with some burdens only on a certain narrow class of depository institutions. Whatever rules we have in this regard ought to apply pretty much equally across the board. So that's a concern. The bill provides that you couldn't close an account without, and apparently this is any account. It's not just a consumer account. A lot of times these bills are written to protect folks that we call consumers. Well, this would apply to an account held by General Motors or anybody else, as well as to the consumer account. So I don't know whether that was really the intent, but it would require that you give 60 days prior notice. The bill makes no exception for some situations where I think you'd really want to make an exception. For instance, where the account owner has died, you ought not to have to give 60 days advance notice of closing that account. Where the account has a zero or negative balance, you ought to be able to just communicate to the account holder that the account is closed. Counter holder assumes that's the case anyway, so shouldn't be a 60-day notice requirement there. Where the account grants what we call a security interest in the funds that are on deposit and to secure some loan that the customer has taken out, and that interest has been foreclosed because the customer didn't follow through on paying the debt. In that case, the funds have been taken to satisfy the debt, because that's what the security interest was for, and we ought not to have to give a 60-day prior notice to close that account. Similar situation is where the funds in the account have been taken by garnishment. We get lots of garnishments from creditors trying to reach the property of customers who haven't paid their debts. If the funds are drained out of the account by garnishment, we ought not to have to give a 60-day notice in that situation. There may be cases where we are required to close the account because of a change in the applicable regulations. As you know, banks are heavily regulated by both state and federal governments, and they change their rules all the time. And sometimes those rules actually have an impact on the kinds of accounts that we can offer. Again, we don't want the burden of having to provide notice to all these customers if that should arise. And also, there's no provision in here, no exception in here for being able to close the account without this 60-day notice where the customer has violated the terms of the deposit agreement. The deposit agreement is a contract between the financial institution and the customer. And, for instance, agreement says that the customer is not permitted under the terms of this account to overdraw the balance, and that's required by law on savings accounts, by the way. If it says that and the customer nevertheless overdraws the account by some means, we ought to be able to close that account based upon the violation of the contract, and we shouldn't have to give 60 days notice to do that. It also says in this bill that when we give this notice, we have to provide a reason for the closure. And though the bill doesn't exactly say this, it implies that there must be a reason that we no longer would have the right to close the account just because of a change in our business policies or whatever. We'd have to have a reason. It doesn't say what kind of a reason, whether it has to be any reason at all, or does it have to be a good reason, and what is a good reason? There is some language that says that all of this notice business wouldn't apply in the case of use of the account for illegal activity. But that term isn't defined, and we don't have the slightest idea where that begins and ends. So that's another problem for us. The final thing that I would point out is that there is existing law in the Bank Act, and I believe also in the credit union statute, that requires financial institutions to give their customers advance notice and change of account terms. And certainly the closing of an account is a change in the account terms. So for that matter, we think this problem that has been addressed here is already addressed in the existing statute. So all in all, we have some serious concerns about this bill, and we'd be happy to work proactively with you. But at this point, we have to be in opposition, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Bynum.
Thank you for your testimony. I have two questions. The first is, can you explain why an account holder or their estate would not be notified? That would not fall within something that's reasonable to do. So you said if an account holder has passed, then there's no reason to notify them, except that if the estate doesn't know that the account exists, then is there a mechanism to inform the estate that the account exists?
What usually happens, thank you, Representative, I do some estate administration work as well as the banking work, so I have some basis for answering your question. What normally happens is that the family comes in, the decedent has died, gives us all the information they have about where the decedent had accounts and so forth, and we will normally initiate that communication. The financial institution may, at the beginning, have no idea that this person has passed. So normally the ball starts rolling from the end of the decedent's estate administration. And then what happens is we will send a letter saying, please, first of all, know that this person has died. Secondly, provide us information on all accounts you have in this information, including date of death balances. And it goes on from there. But obviously that money gets paid out to the estate, whether it's a probate or a trust administration. Does that respond to your question?
Mr. Chairman,
follow up.
My concern would be is if a family does not have the resources to be represented by people who understand how to wind down a person's affairs,
right,
that they may not be notified, especially a family that may be transient. They may not be notified fairly or properly that their loved one has funds in an account.
Certainly. Well, there are lots of estates where that's the case, where there is no lawyer involved, and where the family just handles it on its own. There's already a provision in the Bank Act that allows a family member, typically the spouse, but children can do it too, to go to the bank, sign an affidavit saying this person has died, and to have the funds in the account paid out based upon that affidavit. As far as the bank initiating the notice process, the problem there is that the bank is not typically going to know that this person has passed away. They're account holder, but the banks aren't equipped to monitor each and every, people who have accounts in Salem may live anywhere in the country. And so there's no real practical mechanism. It kind of rests on the family or the lawyer or somebody contacting the bank and saying, this person has passed away. We think there's money there. What do we do about that?
My second question is, when a consumer closes an account, is it not customary for banks to collect the reason for the customer to close the account?
You know, I'm not a bank operations person per se, but I've not ever heard of that. I think people close accounts all the time without providing any reason for doing so. All you have to do to close an account is to go to another institution. This is one of the ways you can do it, and say, I want to open an account with you, and I want to close the account, and the banks internally handle that whole process. So maybe I'm not getting your question, but I don't think customers typically provide financial institutions with reasons for their decision to close an account.
Mr. Chairman, if I could add to Representative Bynum to both of your questions. I think on the first one, I think what Mr. Sherman is saying is, having just gone through this with my father, I went into the financial institutions and we kept his mail address open for a while because I had no idea where he had accounts. I mean, he was 96 years old and he was very old school. He added me to one account right before he passed, and so I was shocked every day to go to the mail and get that. So I think generally, I think what we're saying is, if I come into that institution, say my father's passed, I need to close these accounts, it would be redundant to then have the bank send you a notice to that address saying we're closing your account because you passed, because you already know that. The bank is going to have no, or the credit union for that matter, is going to generally have no sense of when that person has passed. I'm still calling people and saying, you know, my father's passed away. So, I mean, that's, I think, was what Mr. Sherman was trying to say. On your second question, I am sure that there are institutions, just like any business, you know, wants to know reasons for no longer doing business with them. You know, whether it's a bank or a credit union or a grocery store or a fast food restaurant, you know, why are you going across the street and not coming to me? So it wouldn't surprise me if, for statistical purposes, they asked why they were, you know, why you were leaving. But I don't know that certainly it's not a requirement that they do that. But I'm sure there are some institutions that, as good business practice, would ask that. So does that help?
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, Tim, I just wanted to go back to something you said. You said they might have got out of the business of dealing with elected officials.
Right.
So is that legit? I mean, is that political accounts or campaign accounts, or is that just us?
It's just the Oregon legislature. Representative Barreto, and just the Republicans from east of the mountains. Except they messed up with Representative Greenlink. They thought he was across the mountains. You know, I think the point I'm trying to make is that, and Mr. Sherman made it, if you go down today and open up an account at any of the banks or credit unions in town, you're going to sign an agreement that says, I can get rid of you anytime I want, and you can do the same for me. I don't have to give you a reason. You may ask me what the reason, but I don't have to give you a reason. And that's the contract that you okay. sign. You know, my example of car loans, you know, as you know, banks have had a difficult time at the federal level for some time. And, you know, I think some institutions have said these are type of accounts we want, these are ones we don't want. So that's certainly a possibility that they said, across the country, we're not going to do this any longer.
Thank you.
Other questions? Just one more real quick. I know that when a bank closes an account, they don't normally keep the money in the account. They would try to notify whoever the account holder is, and if it's somebody they can't contact, there's a process for it going to unclaimed property.
That's correct.
And so the bank's not, you know, closing accounts on people and keeping the money, so to speak.
No, there's a statutory process, Mr. Chairman, where the bank not only has to do that, but actually if they have an account that's been inactive for a period of time, then they're required to send a report to the state and then follow up with the state and ultimately turn that property over.
And that would apply to both state chartered banks and federally chartered banks, I think.
Yes, it does.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, just to kind of close the loop on that, I encourage everybody once in a while to go on the Division of State Lands and punch in their name. I did discover my dad is owed $50 from a utility company on a deposit that he never got back. So, that is out there, and that does work well.
Okay. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2112? Before you get up, why don't you just stay there?
Stay
there. Yeah. In other words, don't get up. I was trying to save you some effort.
Okay, Ken, sit down. We'll get it.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2112 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2624.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that exempts out-of-state banks, extra-national institutions, and foreign associations that hold certificates of authority to conduct banking business that's issued by DCBS. Exempt them from filing additional notice and paying an additional fee to the department prior to dealing in notes secured by mortgages or trustees. There are no amendments.
Thank you. I have Ken Sherman and Tim Martinez. Evidently, I saved Ken Sherman some exercise, but not Tim Martinez. So if you'd introduce yourself again for the record.
2624.
Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Thank you again for having a hearing on this bill, House Bill 2624. And I neglect to mention on the other bill, but I'll put it in the record now. We had hoped to have the chairman of the Oregon Bankers Association here today to testify on these bills, Jeff Bailey from the Bank of Eastern Oregon over in Heppner. But evidently the gorge is still not in very good shape, and he hit black ice, and he made, I can't imagine his decision, but he turned around and went back instead of continuing on here. So I do apologize for him not being able to make it here today, but hopefully he'll be able to join this committee at a future opportunity.
Mr. Chairman, is that an issue of bankers not being risk takers?
No, being smart.
To continue.
Please continue.
Those of you on this committee last year will remember we rewrote the Bank Act, which is something that the OBA, Oregon Bankers Association, in conjunction with the state regulator, does about once every 20 years. So unless you're going to be here another 18 years, you probably won't have to deal with that issue again. Mr. Sherman has rewritten that, I think, three times now as part of his duties as OBA counsel. It was a fairly lengthy bill. I think it was 60 or 70 pages, which I know, again, looking at some of the members that were here last time, you read every single word and could cite it back to me now without any issues. We made an error. Frankly, we missed a line that somehow did not get into the final version, and we're here to put it back in. Now, I know when you look at the summary, and it sounds like it's a very complicated matter and issue. It's really not. We had a meeting with DCBS last week, I believe. They were somewhat unclear what we were after, but once we explained it to them, it made sense. And hopefully Ken will do it at a level that I can understand, because it's just simply adding in a sentence that was inadvertently left out, and there is for the freshmen, you're going to get tired of hearing this. This is a technical fix, but sometimes it's really true, and in this case, this is one of those.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Ken Sherman, Jr., counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association, and this is truly a simple fix to an oversight that we made in 2015 when we did the last rewrite of the Bank Act. There are, in the Bank Act, institutions called out-of-state banks and extra-national institutions. An out-of-state bank is a bank that's chartered in the state of California or Iowa or someplace, but has an operation here in Oregon. An extra-national institution is one that is chartered by another country, but also has an operation here in Oregon. Those institutions, when they want to come into the state, they have kind of a two tracks to pick from. One track is that they can file an application with the Department of Consumer and Business Services for full authority to engage in what is defined in the Bank Act as banking business. The gold standard of banking business is the ability to take deposits from customers. And if you can do that, then you've got the full ticket. And so that's one way they can go. They can come in and file, I think it's a $2,500 application fee, and jump through all the hoops. And if they get approved, then they are authorized to engage in banking business in the state. Most of the extra national and out-of-state institutions really don't want to go that far. They want to tiptoe into the state, so they choose the second track. And the second track allows them to simply come in and make real estate loans here. And there's a shorter provision of the law in the Bank Act now, and has been for a long time, that allows them to do a more abbreviated application. What we discovered to our chagrin after the 2015 version of the Bank Act passed was that with regard to that second category of out-of-state and extra-national institutions, we had subjected them unwittingly to both processes. If you want to come into the state and you just want to make loans, then you got to jump through both hoops. Probably a better way to say it is, if you come into Oregon as an out-of-state institution and you go through the full process, the old law says that's all you have to do. If you want to make real estate loans, which is just a small part of being a full-fledged bank, then you get to do that because that's part of your charter that you got when you went through the application process. So all this bill does is to put back in language that was in the pre-2015 law that says if you have, as an extra national or out-of-state bank, jump through the full array of hoops, you don't have to repeat the process just to make real estate loans. That's included in what you did the first time around. So that's really all the bill does. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Doherty?
I think this is a clarification on the lines that were deleted, 27 through 29. Was that just a duplication of what you had before?
Yeah, that language I'm looking for, Bill.
Yeah. It says may take, acquire, hold, and enforce notes secured by mortgages and trust deeds. So I assume that deals with the real estate part that you were talking about.
Yes, that language, the Legislative Council actually recommended taking that out. It wasn't in the draft that we submitted, but they said, hey, that language is essentially already up in Section 2.
Yeah, that deals with real estate.
And there's no reason to say it twice,
okay.
And we agreed with that. So.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Forgive me if I missed it, but I was just curious about what foreign associations are.
A foreign association, oh boy, I didn't bring my Bank Act with me. I think it would be like a Federal Savings Association that was chartered to do business in another state. And they're not mentioned in this list. They are at the first part of it, but they're not in the second part.
Okay. I see there's actually a definition that was pointed out to me already in the bill. So
okay.
She answered the question. Thank you. Any other questions? Not seeing any more questions. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can we leave now?
Yes, you may. I will close the was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2624? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2624. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2317.
Members, this is a measure that comes from the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. It increases the term for members who serve on that board from 3 years to 4 years, and it removes requirement that board members hold specific professional licenses and instead requires members to be licensed, certified, or registered by the board. The board also has submitted the -1 amendment, and it replaces the measure. It keeps the same change to the terms, changing it to 3 years, but it changes the requirements for those members to sit on the board, and I'm sure the representative from the board will describe it fully.
Thank you. Welcome. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. My name is Chad Dresselhaus. I am the Education and Compliance Program Manager for the Oregon Orchard Cemetery Board. House Bill 2317 is an agency bill brought forward by our board as a result of our annual strategic stakeholder planning and outreach program and at the request of the Cemetery Association of Oregon. A subsequent amendment to the bill has recently been proposed, so I believe you're in possession of both. Although similar concepts have been submitted in the past, those bills were more complex and included other changes. This bill only makes minor changes and, most importantly, provides all licensees with an opportunity to serve as a board member without the overall balance or size of the board being altered. As a reference, the board has a total of 11 members, which includes 7 industry positions and 4 public members. In addition to providing all licensees with an opportunity to serve on the board, this bill would increase a board member's term from 3 years to 4. Currently, terms are fixed to the calendar rather than when the Senate appointment occurs, oftentimes resulting in a new board member only serving for a remainder of a term. Allowing each board member to serve a full term seems most efficient, especially when our board typically meets only 4 to 6 times a year for regular meetings. This desire for a more effective board is also the motivation behind the return to 4-year terms. Back in 2009, a bill changed the term for all health-related boards from 4 to 3 years, though our board did not request this prior to the change. The final desired outcome is to provide clarification that public members, which can at times be more challenging to find than licensees, would be allowed to continue to serve until a replacement is found. As previously stated, the Cemetery Association of Oregon requested that we bring this bill forward and is supportive of it. The other primary industry associations are officially neutral, but do not oppose the bill as amended. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. If you have, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate the brevity of your comments. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for being here and to at least let us know what this was about.
Thank you very much for your time.
Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2317?
There may be. My understanding is some of the associations may have submitted
testimony
in writing. So
right, right.
That would be the,
yeah, and we'll.
I believe maybe in lieu of testimony.
Thank you. We'll get that on, make sure it's on OLIS. All right. Thank you. With that, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2317 and open up and apologize for jumping around so much, but I'm going to open up a public hearing for House Bill 2562.
Hey, Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that requires the lender for reverse mortgages to annually send a notice to the borrower that informs them that the borrower retains the title to the property and is responsible for paying property taxes, insurance, maintenance, and related taxes, and that failure to do so may cause the reverse mortgage to become due immediately. And it provides that the notice must be provided every year at least 60 days prior to the date that the property taxes are due. There are no amendments.
Thank you. Representative Witt. Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Business and Labor Committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Brad Witt, State Representative, House District 31, appearing before you this afternoon in favor of House Bill 2562, which is a combination reverse mortgage notification of tax bill. Very simple, very straightforward bill that would require the lender of reverse mortgages to notify the borrower annually of the borrower's obligation to pay property taxes on the property where the mortgage has originated. The bill provides for 60 days advance notice of those taxes being done, or being due, rather, excuse me. Our local newspaper, the Chronicle, which I think the story is being passed out to you, tells the story of 83-year-old Eleanor Ashley, and I'll quote from that article. Ms. Ashley stating, I wasn't aware I was supposed to pay the taxes. Tax bills were being sent directly to her mortgage company. Quote, they waited 10 years, then sent me a bill. Her mortgage company showed her $21,000 behind in taxes, and the company foreclosed on her property. I would ask that Mr. Chairman, that you and the committee members please be aware that this problem is happening statewide. I would speculate that much of the confusion, and oftentimes among our elderly population, has to do with some of the advertisements, and they are particularly frequent on the Sunday morning news talk shows, where formerly Fred Thompson and more recently Henry Winkler come out in essence tell you that it's the best thing since sliced bread, and you can hook into your cash cow and live happily ever after. And I think that a lot of people assume incorrectly that once the cash starts rolling in, that the cash is rolling in, that you aren't having to pay anything out. This bill tries to overcome that problem. The community action team from Columbia County suggests that this has become a very serious problem in terms of the number of people who are unaware that they owe these property taxes under a reverse mortgage. And this bill is simply a notification, hoping that with that notification we can overcome delinquent taxes and the foreclosures that have happened not only to Eleanor Ashley, but a host of other people. I would want to point out, Mr. Chairman, that I am not aware of opposition to this bill. However, there will be a minor amendment in that it would be possible to make an arrangement with your lender to have the lender pay the taxes due. In which case, if those taxes are being paid, it might catch you by surprise that you would get a notice for taxes due. So in that instance, obviously the notice would not be going to the borrower. A very minor amendment. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions that you or the committee might have.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Witt?
Do we have the authority?
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. Do we have the ability to subpoena Henry Winkler and have him explain himself?
Well, no. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are any of these reverse mortgages made with the provision that they pay the taxes, like you mentioned in the amendment, or up until now, are they just the reverse mortgage and then the owner is responsible?
I am told that in a few rare circumstances that has been the case. I think it has been, at least to this point, somewhat rare. But the amendment will address that potential exigency. So,
further questions, Representative Hack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, is it true that they then get a statement, like an escrow statement, that would indicate to them that the taxes had been paid as part of their escrow account, so they wouldn't get statements from the county for the tax roll, what they would owe in the property taxes? Are they required to give them an escrow statement that would show whether it's paid or not paid?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hack, I would assume that that's the case, although I am not expert enough on escrow statements to be able to confirm that. But I would imagine that good accounting principles would dictate that would be the case, but I can't testify to that.
We're just a follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this would alleviate any question whether or not, I mean, they're going to get the statement regardless. This is going to say you have to give them. So there's no surprise
we're going to make sure they get it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's exactly the case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sam Bynum, question?
Thank you. The exhibit, I guess, that you gave, I was a little confused because usually when you get your tax statement, you get it's one color if you have to pay it directly, and it's another color if your mortgage company pays it. And so I'm trying to understand how a tax bill gets in the hands of a mortgage company and the mortgage company decides not to pay it and not to inform the homeowner.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Bynum, I am curious about that also. And again, it would be purely speculative on my part, but I suspect that somebody at the county level may have been sending mortgage statements someplace where they maybe shouldn't have been going. I cannot answer that.
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say thank you to Representative Witt for bringing this bill to the committee. Seems like a good bill.
Thank you, Representative Hurd. Appreciate that.
And I thank you as well, Representative Witt. I know you brought a bill forward previous on reverse mortgages that we dealt with, and this seems like another good step. I am aware that sometimes those things are handled through escrow and the lender's responsibility to pay those taxes. Kind of flows through escrow. So we'll work with you or other interested parties in developing an amendment as such.
I will be bringing that amendment forward, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then let committee administrator know that you're working on it, and we'll proceed from there.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I don't see anyone else signed up to testify in House Bill 2562. Is there... Oh, there is someone else. I'm sorry, I didn't see your name.
My apologies, Chair. So, I missed the sign-up sheet. I apologize.
Please identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of this bill, and we appreciate Representative Witt's bringing this forward. And I will just be very brief in saying that when I sent this bill out to our offices, got immediate feedback that they had seen, our folks had seen a couple of examples of this exact problem recently where some elderly folks with reverse mortgages had been confused, and by the time they figured out that they were still under an obligation to pay their taxes, the amount that they owed was a significant amount, and they were then in a financial bind and concerned about the threat of foreclosure. So we think this is a practical and low-cost way to try to alleviate that problem and prevent it. So thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Anyone else that signed up that I didn't see?
Thank you.
So with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2562 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2359.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is the measure that removes the requirement that the beneficiary send to the Attorney General a copy of the notice that goes to the homeowner informing them that they are not eligible for a foreclosure avoidance measure or that the homeowner has not complied with the terms of a foreclosure avoidance measure. There are no amendments before you, and this is a measure that came from the Attorney General's office.
Thank you. So we have Cheryl Hemstra and Janet Forth. Hopefully I didn't butcher your names.
You did quite well.
I know I've met both of you several times, but so welcome if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Hemstra, and I'm the Deputy Legislative Director at the Oregon Department of Justice. With me today is Assistant Attorney General Janet Borth, who's our expert in this area. And I'll turn it over to her shortly, but just basically the punchline of this bill is just we're trying to do good stewardship of our resources. It's a cleanup about a copy of a notice we get. And so we're just, again, trying to be good stewards of our resources here. We vetted this with the Housing Committee community, and it doesn't affect any any of the consumer protections that are in the existing law. This is just a cleanup bill. So with that, I'll turn it over to Janet for some background.
Thanks. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Janet Borth. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice. To remind the committee just briefly of how we got here, in 2012, 2013, the legislature passed a series of foreclosure reforms. One component of that addressed the what's commonly called the practice of dual tracking, in which a homeowner would submit an application for a loan modification, understand that application to be in process, and have a foreclosure initiated against that homeowner while still thinking that they were under review. And so sometimes folks were still all in on the loss mitigation option. And so is it 86-748 requires the homeowner under Oregon law to be notified when they've been denied within 10 days of being denied for a foreclosure avoidance measure to avoid that sort of confusion. And it later requires the lender to confirm when they seek a foreclosure that they told the homeowner if they were denied. At that time, there was it was a chaotic time in the foreclosure crisis, and so the decision was made to send a copy of each and have the lender send a copy of each and every one of those notices to the Attorney General's office. We don't think, in a nutshell, we don't know that the need is there anymore. We think this is an important protection for homeowners. We're just talking about the notice. And if we did have a concern about ongoing dual tracking, we would still have all of our usual subpoena and investigative authority if we wanted to look into things on a more targeted basis.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? So is the... Does the beneficiary need to send a notice to anyone then if this requirement is taken away?
Chair Holvey, that's correct. Yes, the notice still needs to go to the consumer. Okay, and the consumer, I believe, can seek a $200 penalty for a failure to do so. And we've heard anecdotally that a few have done that.
Answers my question. So don't see any other questions. Thank you for bringing the bill forward. And we don't have to revisit this again, but we'll see.
All right. Thank you.
Anyone else want to testify on House Bill 2359? Not seeing any. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2359 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2572.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2572 allows the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to issue a multi-year license to qualifying farm labor contractors and construction labor contractors. There are no amendments before you, and this bill was brought to you by the Commissioner Foley.
Great. So we will start out with hearing from Gerhard Pobble and Paloma Sparks. 2572.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. If you'd identify yourselves for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. House Bill 2572 is a simple bill. Right now, labor contractors are required to be licensed with the Bureau of Labor and Industries, but they can only get licenses for 1 year. It's a lot of paperwork for labor contractors. This bill would allow them, as long as they are in good standing, to get multi-year licenses for 2 or 4 year licenses. And that's it. Gerhard Teubel is our administrator of the Wage and Hour Division. He's here to give you a little more background about how labor contractor licenses work.
Good afternoon. My name is Gerhard Teubel. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at Boley. As you just heard, the Boley enforces the licensing regulations for farm, forest, and construction labor contractors, which are persons who recruit, solicit, supply, or employ workers to perform labor for another in the production or harvesting of farm products, deforestation or reforestation of lands, and construction. These regulations were first enacted by the legislature sometime back in the late 1950s, and they've been amended from time to time over the years. And their aim is to protect agricultural, forest, and construction laborers by ensuring that labor contractors have the financial security to pay them their wages, that they are properly licensed or properly insured to protect workers in case of injury or accidents, and that they are familiar with their obligations under the state's labor laws. As Paloma mentioned, the law currently requires a labor contractor to apply for a license on an annual basis, which means that every year the labor contractor needs to come in before the valid license expires and renew. And as part of that renewal process, they submit an application, as they're required to do every year, along with documentation about, you know, motor vehicles that they may be using in their business, and proof of vehicle insurance, proof of workers' compensation insurance, the names and addresses of all persons financially interested in the business, as well as, importantly, proof of financial security, typically in the form of a bond or a security deposit of some kind, to ensure that wages can be paid in case the contractor fails to do so. During the licensing process, we also ask that they provide us with documentation to show that they are current with all taxes, so with Department of Revenue, Oregon Employment Department, and the IRS. Last year, Boley's licensing unit, which consists of a single individual, issued more than 400 licenses to Oregon contractors, which is more than a 20% increase over the number of licenses just 5 years ago. This bill proposes to amend the labor contracting license requirements by permitting, under certain circumstances, that a labor contractor can apply for and obtain a license either for a period of 2 years or 4 years. Eligibility for this kind of license, for a multi-year license, would require that the contractor has at least had a license for 2 years, and in those 2 years has not been found to have violated either the licensing regulations or the labor laws, and that no wage claims have been filed against that contractor during that period of time. Our intent in making this proposal is basically twofold. First, contractors with a track record of compliance would be able to obtain licenses for longer intervals, and in the process would save themselves time having to come in every year, and possibly resources of coming in every year and supplying us with the documentation that they need to renew their license. Secondly, it would be of benefit to Boley as well, because by allowing some of these contractors to get licenses for longer periods of time, we wouldn't have to process as many licenses within one single year, so we could spread out the licensing process over 2 or 4 years in some cases, which would help productivity, I think, on Boley's end. We don't believe that licensing contractors for 2 or 4 year periods will impede the agency's ability to enforce the licensing requirements, or that it will create conditions which might encourage contractors to violate the licensing requirements or the wage and hour regulations. The option for obtaining a license for a longer period does not do away with the contractor's other obligations or duties under the law. Contractors would still be required to submit to Boley certified payroll reports showing where work was performed, when it was performed, who performed it, what they were paid. They would still be required to provide their workers with disclosure statements prior to hiring, the work agreement essentially showing what they would be paid and how they would be paid. They would still be required to maintain financial security and insurance for the entire period of the license, whether that's 1 year, 2 years, or 4 years. And I think ultimately Boley would still have the authority to suspend or revoke the license of a labor contractor who was found to have violated the law. So it's for these reasons that we don't believe that the 2 or 4 year licenses would negatively affect the workers whom these licensing requirements are meant to protect. So I'd like to thank you for your consideration of this proposal, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
I just wanted to add one more thing. Paloma Sparks, Bureau of Labor and Industries. The Farm Bureau has asked for a technical clarifying amendment. We're working with them. We're happy to support such an amendment.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Barreto.
Sure. So when these contractors hire these people to work under them or contract with them, do they require from each one of these workers either a green card or Social Security or something to verify that they're here legally?
Representative Holy, Representative Barreto, I don't know whether they do or not. They're not required under the licensing regulations to do that.
Follow up. So all you do is you're just dealing with the contractor, but not anything under that as far as who he hires.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? I was wondering if I have a question. Maybe I hope try not to use a hypothetical, but what constitutes a valid claim? And I guess my question is, the bill says that they'll make this endorsement if they have no valid claims for unpaid wages that have been made against the applicant. And so if there's an unpaid wage claim and the employer then satisfies that at a later date, does that remain a valid claim for unpaid wages that have been made?
Representative Holvey, I believe that it would. I mean, if there was either a claim that was, say, adjudicated, and then it was found that the employer owed wages, that would be a valid claim. I think in this context, if there was a claim that, say, Boley investigated and found that wages were owed, and the employer then, say, settled that claim, that would still be a valid claim.
So you would keep a record of that ongoing?
Well,
for how long would that apply to the labor contractor?
Well, for the purposes of this, it would be in a 2-year period of time if there was a valid claim within the two-year period of time. And yes, we do keep record of the wage claims that we receive and the outcome of those claims.
Is that true for keeping records on wage claims in general at Boley, that they would keep a record of that even after the employer had adjudicated or satisfied that claim if it was found that they owed it? Would you still keep that record?
Representative Holy, we keep the records as long as the public records law, I mean the actual record, like for example the claims file, we would keep for a certain number of years. For example, if it's just a wage claim that wasn't adjudicated, we would keep that record for 2 years. But then in addition to that, we have a case tracking system, electronic system that we have, which is goes much further back than that, so we would be able to see if
you would be able to identify an employer who just continually has these wage claims going back into the past, so you would see this pattern over and over again, and that would perhaps cause you not to give them another endorsement going forward.
Yes, if those claims were filed with Boley, we would be able to see that.
Okay. All right. Representative Hack, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just a point of clarification, kind of what I'm understanding. It's not that you're not going to hold the labor contractors accountable to the same rules and regulations that you always have. All you're trying to do here is just to cut some red tape, not make them come in every year, but nothing's going to change as far as the accountability piece goes. We're just trying to actually cut a little red tape here, make it a little easier for the contractors. Am I understanding that right?
Chair Holvey, Representative Hack, that's correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, Ben Eckstein, or Eckstein. Jenny Dressler. And I think Betsy Earle slipped out. But she was on the list, so if she's outside listening. Welcome, if you'd identify yourselves for the record.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, my name is Ben Eckstein. I'm here on behalf of the Columbia Gorge Fruit Growers. Thank you for the opportunity to express our support today for House Bill 2572. Columbia Gorge Fruit Growers is comprised of 440 growers and 20 shippers of tree fruit in the mid-Columbia region. And we want to thank the Bureau of Labor and Industries for reaching out to us and our members and for undertaking this effort to streamline the labor contractor regulatory process. House Bill 2572 would provide much appreciated dose of regulatory relief to labor contractors who have demonstrated consistent compliance with BOLI rules, cutting time and cost for law-abiding labor contractors and the state. By reducing the regulatory barriers that our industry faces in fulfilling demand for labor, HB 2572 would allow us to operate more efficiently and to spend less time and money on paperwork, leaving us with more resources to do our jobs and market our products. And for these reasons, we support House Bill 2572, and thank you for this opportunity.
Hi, thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We have 7,000 farm and ranch families who are members of our organization and 65,000 members statewide. We are here also today to express support for House Bill 2572. Good bill cuts red tape. I'm sure you hear and you will continue to hear from small business owners and family businesses about the paperwork burden that they face and whether our folks are actually licensed contractors or whether they're utilizing licensed contractors. The hope is for us that we either save time or money and can keep these folks moving. So thank you again. And with regard to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, we are working with them on a technical amendment on Section 2, Subsection 3 around endorsement around employee endorsement. So but looking forward to working with them and really appreciate their work to help us get some clarity there. Thank you.
Thank you. Just keep our committee analyst in in the loop, so when you get that, you can get it back to her as awesome. Soon as possible. Thank you very much. Are there questions of this panel?
No.
Not seeing any? You're good to go.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2572? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2572. Open a work session on House Bill 2609. Jan, would you remind us about this bill, or maybe not remind us, because mm-hmm. we haven't really talked about this mm-hmm. bill, but tell us what process we're mm-hmm. going through here mm-hmm. so the committee
Mr.
knows.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this bill was referred to your committee. However, it's a subject matter that's probably best dealt with at House Judiciary Committee, and they would like to receive it. So the process would be for the committee to move it without recommendation to House Judiciary. And it does not go to the floor for a vote until it moves out of House Judiciary.
Representative Bynum, would you like to make a motion?
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2609 without recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Oh, and I'm sorry, that was my mistake.
Judiciary. My House mistake, Committee sorry. On Judiciary. So just state it again.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2609 without recommendation to the committee, the Judiciary Committee.
Very good. Representative Bynum moves House Bill 2609 without recommendation to the Committee on Judiciary. Is there discussion? Seeing no discussion, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes, and we'll send that one off.
No objection, Greg.
Close the work session on House Bill 2609, and open a work session on House Bill 2161.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that you heard on first day of session. It came to you from the Employment Relations Board. It allows the,
Credit unions.
Yes, excuse me. All messed up today. House Bill 2161 comes to you from the credit unions, and they are asking that the ability to amend their credit union bylaws become effective automatically 30 days after they submit their request to the Department of Consumer Business Services Director. The department would still have the authority to disapprove or require additional information before those bylaw changes goes into effect. Also allows the credit union to expel a member who creates undue risk, allows the DCBS director to set a minimum frequency of meetings for the credit union board, and allows state chartered credit unions to exercise powers that are available as of January 1, 2017 to those credit unions that operate in Oregon, but they are holding a federal charter or they're chartered by another state. The credit unions asked for the Dash 1 amendment, and they discussed it in the public hearing last week. And that amendment would require the credit unions, when they're amending the articles of incorporation, that those changes would only go into effect when the DCBS director has provided written approval. There is a minimal revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the Dash 1 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Barreto, would you like to try this one?
Chair Holby, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to HB 2161.
Representative Barreto moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2161. Is there discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to adopting the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2161? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Chair Holby, I move House Bill 2161 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2161 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, will the committee assistant call the roll, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Mankey?
Aye.
Representative Pack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. The motion passes, and Representative Fahey, I think you would be a good person to carry this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think she'd be great.
Mr. Chair.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2161.
Dump all the work on the freshman. It's your turn now.
And open a work session on House Bill 2262.
Mr. Chair, this is the measure that comes from the Employment Relations Board. 2262 allows the Employment Relations Board to employ management service and unclassified employees. Changes the title of their executive secretary to an executive manager and makes that position an unclassified service position. Changes the status of the head of the state conciliation service to an unclassified position, and it removes the requirement that the board, acting at the direction of the executive staff, that they estimate future expenses and costs for purposes of their state agency assessments. It allows only labor organization to petition to add unrepresented employees to an existing unit, requires a petition for representation without election to be signed by a majority of employees, and it adds employees of mass transit districts, transportation districts, and municipal bus systems to the statutes that affect those strike-prohibited employees. There are no amendments. There's no revenue impact, and there's no fiscal impact. However, the budget analyst who has looked at this bill is requesting that the committee add a referral to Ways and Means. They would like to look at it when they're looking at the budget for the Employment Relations Board, now that the bill gives them the authority to hire and set salaries for management and unclassified service.
Thank you. Representative Bynum.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2262 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Bynum moves House Bill 2262 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion? Seeing none, shall our committee assistant call the roll, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Beimer?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2263, having received the required votes, is passed. Close the work session on House Bill 2263. Open a work, or 2262, excuse me. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2263.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure also comes to you from the Employment Relations Board. You heard it on the first day of session. It increases the maximum fee to $625 for the third mediation session, and it lowers the maximum fee to $625 for the fourth mediation session. Allows the board to establish fees for providing labor relations and negotiation training. There is no amendment, there is no revenue impact, and there's no fiscal impact. The bill was referred to the committee with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. The budget analyst has looked at it, and because the increased fee is offset by the lowered fee, they do not see a need to look at it anymore, so they're asking that you rescind that subsequent referral and send it straight to the floor.
Thank you. Representative Barreto, would you like to
make a motion? Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2263 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Barreto moves House Bill 2263 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Discussion? Seeing none, shall our committee assistant call the roll?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2263, having received the required votes, is passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2263. Representative Doherty, could you carry that one for us?
Here.
Thank you. And open a work session on House Bill 2264.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is a measure also coming from the Employment Relations Board.
36 hours.
Increases the application fee for a person to be included on the State Conciliation Services list of qualified arbitrators. The fee would move from $50 to $100, and the annual fee to remain on the list would move from $100 to $150. There is no revenue impact. The fiscal statement has been issued, and there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
There is?
Mm-hmm. It originally came to the committee with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And unlike the previous bill, this one would still go to Ways and Means.
All righty. Representative Biden, would you like to make that motion?
Mr. Chair, I move HB 2264 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Bynum moves House Bill 2264 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion? Seeing none. Committee assistant, shall we have a roll call, please?
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Adams?
Yes.
Representative Fahey?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bynum?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2264, having received the votes, is passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2264. Jan, do we have any bill introductions for today?
There are no bill introductions.
other notes of interest?
There is none.
With that, the House Committee on Business and Labor is adjourned.